rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And a beautiful Thursday to you. Greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast. Welcome back, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Should Bob Novak go to jail? Should Bob Novak go to jail? I think this is a legitimate question. You know, Bob Novak, here we have, apparently Time Magazine now has said that they are, I mean, this is really, we're kind of going into the twilight zone of journalism, right? Time Magazine has said that they're going to turn over the notes. Rather than send Matt Cooper to prison, they're going to turn over their notes to the prosecutor. This prosecutor for the administration who's investigating the outing of Valerie Plame. The outing of Valerie Plame, you will recall, the result of her husband, Joe Wilson, having written an op-ed piece for the New York Times saying that George Bush was lying to us in his State of the Union address when he used the argument that the British intelligence had found that Saddam Hussein was trying to get Africa from Niger, that the Bush administration knew it was a lie, George Bush knew it was a lie, the people who put it in his speech knew it was a lie, and Joe Wilson, you know, comes out and says this in the New York Times, and so they punish his wife. So then you have Joe Wilson, of course, saying...
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs.
And being a lifelong diplomat, and in fact at one time, you know, the ambassador representing the United States to Iraq just before the Gulf War, Wilson's very careful with his words.
And trust me, when I use that name, I measure my words.
Yeah, so he's pretty sure that he knows that Karl Rove has a hand in this. Of course, I'm not surprised. Now, Karl Rove, you know, without Karl Rove, Bush would not be president. And so George Bush, of course, he's not so excited about finding that leaker.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah, I don't have any idea. So, well, the prosecutor may, but he may not. Bob Novak was on Inside Politics yesterday, and he was talking about this. Here, the fellow that John Stewart on The Daily Show likes to refer to as the scumbag for liberty, Robert Novak.
Why is it that there are two reporters out there who may go to jail, Bob, but it doesn't appear that you're going to go to jail?
Well, that's what I can't reveal until this case is finished. I hope it's finished soon, and when it does, I agree with Mr. Sapphire, I will reveal all in a column. And
hopefully a column that will be read by many people and for which you will be well paid by the Chicago Tribune. Novak continues...
Do you understand why, in general, there's frustration among fellow journalists that after 41 years of distinguished work, where you've always pushed...
Distinguished work? Bob Novak has been a right-wing hack for 40... Well, okay, well, maybe a few early years of distinguished work. Anyhow, back to the question.
And been a fierce advocate of the public right to know. You're not letting the public know about such a critical case, and two people made it go to jail.
Well, they're not going to jail because of me. Answer your questions or not, has nothing to do with that.
Yeah. Well, a little light on this, Bob, would be useful. I mean, you know, maybe they're not going to jail because of you, but you know, if you'd never published the story in the first place, would there be an investigation? Would they not be going to jail? So, you know, Bob Novak, once again, let's say charitably, prevaricating.
That's very ridiculous to think that...
Now he does what he does so well, what conservatives always do. When you present them with facts, or even an argument that's arguable, but it's an argument, rather than taking on the argument, they attack the person. Oh, you're stupid. I can't believe you'd say that. You don't know what you're talking about. You're an uninformed idiot. That kind of stuff. This is classic Novak.
I'm the cause of their going to jail. I don't think they should be going to jail, though.
Yeah, but I didn't say you were the cause, but there are some people...
You did.
No, but
yes,
some people
you did.
Feel that if you would come forward with the information that you have that maybe they
would
not
go to jail. You don't know anything about the case, and those people say that there's no anything about the case. And unfortunately, somebody who would like to talk to write, I'd like to say a lot about the case, but because of my attorney's advice, I can't. But I will, and there might be some surprising things.
Yeah, there might be some surprising things. Well, if Bob Novak is going to write about it, you can bet it's not going to hurt Republicans. So where are we going to go with this? I'm telling you, I don't see it happening anywhere. This twilight zone, this reporter's twilight zone. 2 years ago, this whole thing started. Matt Cooper and Judith Miller, Matt Cooper of Time, Judith Miller of the New York Times. Are they going to go to jail if they don't reveal their names? Why pressure Cooper and Miller and not Novak? Has he already rolled over? Has he already turned them in? Is the public served by turning reporters into snitches? I mean, the historic ideal, both, that the founders had when they wrote into the First Amendment that Congress should make no laws restricting the freedom of press, which in my opinion would include laws that would compel members of the press to testify about crimes, about knowledge of crimes. When they wrote that in, it was because they viewed the Fourth Estate, what's historically referred to as the Fourth Estate, they viewed this as a balance on government, as a balance to the power of government, as the watchdogs of government. Well, what we have now, I mean, as much as we've had governments over the years, administrations over the years, let's say, who didn't like the media. I mean, it comes with the territory. Bill Clinton complained about the media picking on him. You know, they were all hysterical about Monica. Richard Nixon hated the media. Jack Kennedy was a little wary about the media. I suppose Jack Kennedy had a fairly decent relationship with the media. Lyndon Johnson certainly didn't like, he was very upset about the way the media was covering the Vietnam War. But now we have an administration that is actually not just complaining about the media, but out there trying to take control of the media through its proxies, through its friends, through its corporate buddies. General Electric, big defense contractor, owns MSNBC, or owns a good chunk of MSNBC, owns all of NBC. And they come in when Phil Donahue's on the air and they say, you know, the president's ginning up for war. We're going to go to war. I know he's saying that we're not going to go to war, but we're going to go to war. So get that Phil Donahue off the air. We've got to have flag wavers in here. And Chris Matthews, get some more right-wingers on the air. The Chris Matthews Show has become the official phony front group for right-wing, blithering on TV. It's just amazing. I used to have some respect for Chris Matthews. Now it's just tragic watching him. It's saddening. So anyhow, this classic idea that the Fourth Estate, that the press is supposed to be the watchdog of government, well, that's something the Bush administration just won't have. They don't want anybody to be their watchdog. They don't want you coming into a speech that the president's giving, even if it's being paid for with taxpayer dollars. Even if you have a ticket, where did this begin, right? You've got to have a ticket to hear the president. But even if you had a ticket from your member of Congress, oh, we found that you have on your car a no blood for oil bumper sticker. I know you're behaving nicely, but you're not one of us. Out! This administration is moving us so far and so fast in a Stalinist direction. I mean, I don't know a word, and I hate using that, because Stalin, I mean, you know, Stalin killed 20 million people. He was insane. He was genuinely insane. He was paranoid, probably paranoid, schizophrenic, certainly paranoid, clinically paranoid, and, you know, killed people, terrible, terrible things. Far beyond even the worst imaginations of George Bush. And yet the strategies that Stalin used to gain and consolidate power are very similar to the strategies that are being used by this administration. You know, short of murder. Now, I know that there are those out there who are concerned about all the suspicious deaths that have surrounded George W. Bush, just like there were those who were talking about suspicious deaths around Bill Clinton. I'm not going to go there. But the idea of getting control of the media and taking control of the media and trying to control how people think. This is, if you go to, you got to see this picture. This is quite incredible. You know, the flag has 13 stars and stripes. Right? There's 13 for the original 13 colonies. And then there's the 50 stars in the field. Right? And so when you hang the flag, you would think that there would be 13 stars and stripes showing, right? And all 50 stars. But interestingly, when Bush gave his speech night before last, the flags hanging behind him when he was giving that speech were folded to hide some of the stars and to hide some of the stripes. So that what you see, if you look at it from a distance, or if you let your eyes go a little bit of out of focus, is you see what looks like a nine, that is the blue field being the kind of circle part of the nine, down on a red stripe, and then two stripes past that, 9-1-1. And I kid you not, take a look, go to tomhartman.com, and go to, if you want to drop into our live chat room, of course, drop, click live chat, but you can also go to our message boards. I put it on the KPOJ, my morning show, KPOJ, I put it on there just a few hours ago. Go to the Tom's local program, Portland program, KPOJ, and there you can see the picture. And that's, by the way, originally was posted on Michael Moore's website. And it's Bush standing in front of a subliminal 9/11 display. A subliminal 9/11 display. And then on top of that, in terms of, you know, manipulating us and our opinion of what he's doing, turns out, remember that one applause line in his speech? That one time in his speech when somebody actually applauded and said, hey, good on you. Turns out it was his staff, his advance men, sitting in the front row, who started the applause. But even more interesting, ABC, NBC, and Fox reported the fact that Bush staffers started the applause, but MSNBC and CNN did not. They didn't go near it. Right? On MSNBC, Chris Matthews, let's go to Newsweek magazine managing editor John Meacham. John Meacham says, I think he certainly spoke nobly and well. He linked this struggle to our noblest moments throughout our history from the Revolution forward. It was striking to me that the one moment of applause at that very well-disciplined military crowd was that we stay, good heavens, that we stay in the fight until the fight is won, and he evoked the virtues and values of courage and tenacity and sacrifice. I mean, this is really quite remarkable. Here's John Meacham, MSNBC, saying, isn't it great? Look at this. And it turns out, in fact, that it was a Bush staffer. John Meacham. Yeah, everything's fine. Don't worry. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. 20 minutes past the hour. Number 1-866-889-8894.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
What kind of fool do you take me for?
Well, apparently George takes us all for fools. I can't. Can you believe that speech he gave night before? 9/11. It was five times. 9/11. And Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. We were in Afghanistan trying to find the people who did 9/11, and George Bush says, let's leave Afghanistan and head over to Iraq. Yes, indeed. We got to go over to Iraq. You know, there's good reasons to be in Iraq. I'm not sure exactly what they are, but Dick Cheney tells me that
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
But even more importantly, Karl Rove tells me that if we can have a really big war, I mean a really good war that'll last for a while, then I can get reelected in 2004, and we can take back the Senate in 2002, all kinds of good. We'll get political capital. And that's what it was all about. That's what it was all about. All right, by the way, I got to say, you know you're really dedicated to radio. Here I am in the studio. at we do this show from the studios of KPOJ, which is a station where I do a morning show in Portland, Oregon, on the banks of the Willamette River, in the Willamette River Valley here in the People's Republic of Portland. And the fire alarm went off about a minute and a half before I wrapped up the last segment. You might have been able to hear it in the background. There was a beep, 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 and the strobe light going off right in my face. I could hardly see. And everybody's running down the halls. The building's evacuating. And I thought, nah, we're going to continue the show. The show must go on. So we're still trying to find out what's going on there. As far as I can tell, the building's still evacuated. But we're here. We're here. And I really think that whatever it was, it's under control now, because the alarms just went off. I mean, just stopped going off. You know, went off as opposed to went on. You know what I'm talking about. Anyhow, our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call into the program. Megan in Akron, Ohio, on the line, listening on Radio Free Ohio.
Right.
Hey, Megan, welcome to the program.
Hi. I just have a question. Do you think John Bolton could possibly be the leak?
No, I don't. Because it's pretty clear that this was probably either Scooter Libby or somebody in Karl Rove's office. I do think, however, that John Bolton was right in the middle of the whole effort to phony up intelligence about the war. And that's the kind of documentation, about what was going on with the forging and phonying and stovepiping intelligence that led to the Iraq War, that Congress is really trying to get. I mean, the Democrats, they're really furious about this because it's clear to them, it's clear to Congress, that they were lied to. I mean, you had members of Congress like John Kerry coming out and saying, among others, coming out and saying, if you saw the intelligence that I saw,
right,
then
well,
you'd be concerned.
That's what made me think it was John Bolton, because of Voinovich.
Yeah.
And he was so upset on the floor of the Senate that there was something that he knew about John Bolton that he couldn't tell, and therefore
right.
He was that upset. Living in Ohio, we very rarely see George Voinovich get upset about anything.
Yeah,
so
he said this was a matter of his conscience, and he went against his party.
Well,
I am convinced. I don't think it has anything to do with the Valerie Plame leak, but I think that what Voinovich probably knows about Bolton, and frankly that he would like to see revealed, is that Bolton was part of the cabal that was lying to Congress, basically,
right.
That was lying to Congress. And that's why the Republicans are absolutely refusing to release the information on who was Bolton spying on. Because apparently Bolton was part of the cabal that was doing this. He might have even been the enforcer. Because
might,
at the same
I
time...
Maybe, I thought maybe he, because a senior administration official he was...
Right.
Could have been, of course they'll find it out if they look at phone records to find out who was talking to whom in the White House at the time. So
yeah. Well, the big thing with Bolton is they're trying to find out who was he spying on. He was asking for these NSA intercepts, which are telephone taps, right? And he was asking for these NSA intercepts on people within the Bush administration. Why was he spying on people within the Bush administration? I'm convinced it's because he was involved in the conspiracy to lie to Congress. And I'm guessing that some of the people that he was spying on were probably members of Congress. And Congress is, concerned about that. Or if not members of Congress, people who were part of the conspiracy to lie to Congress and to lie to us about weapons of mass destruction so that George could have his war, so that he could have his political capital. And then he could go after Social Security. Megan, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. It's the Tom Hartman Program, the place where smart people get their news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Tom Hartman here with you. CNN, after the president's speech, after the one applause moment that was prompted by staffers, by Bush staffers, the same kind of folks who throw you out of Bush meetings if they discover that your car has a no oil for no blood for oil bumper sticker on it. The CNN Wolf Blitzer talking. He says. And so the President of the United States, wrapping up a speech to the nation, only interrupted once by applause when the President simply said, "We will stay and fight in the fight until the fight is won." And then the troops at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, interrupted the President and politely applauded him, he says. And then Dana Bash, "Well, Wolf, as you just mentioned, it was quite noteworthy that there was only a round of applause at one particular moment. They were very careful to be sort of sedate in the White House, as you mentioned, very understanding of the fact that they could be criticized for having some sort of political rally, blah, blah, blah." She never points out that it was the White House who started the applause. The White House started the applause. And to their credit, ABC, CBS, NBC, they all did report on it. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in. Pat in Ann Arbor, Michigan on the line. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Just a couple of points about President Bush's speech. The first one, the one that really got me laughing, is when he was talking about Saddam's regime, and he used the phrase that they were enjoying the privileges of unchecked power. And the first image that popped into my mind was Tom DeLay.
Yeah, or George Bush.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Tom DeLay golfing in Scotland or smoking a Cuban cigar. I mean, that, you know, what's the difference to that point? And the other thing is he ticked off a number of strategic objectives that supposedly the insurgents failed. You know, they failed to stop the elections. They failed to stop the Constitution. I don't see those as their strategic objectives. I think their strategic objectives are to swell their ranks and increase hatred for the United States and potentially bankrupt us.
Well, I mean, truth be told, It was the Bush administration who came in and said, "You're not going to have elections. We're not going to have elections in Iraq." And Sistani and Sadr got their people out in the streets, many
right.
of those people who are now the insurgents, by the way, and said, "No, we want elections and we want to have a constitution." And what I think from the reports that we're getting from people who have been there and talked with them, they feel that process has been co-opted, that we're putting in another Shah-type government. We're putting in something that looks like a democracy, but it's not. It's a puppet government, and they want to have their own government.
And that leads to my third point. My third point is he implied that a stable democracy will get rid of the radicalism that breeds terrorism. There was no terrorism under Saddam because a brutal dictatorship, a secular one, doesn't allow radicalism either.
Right, right.
But a weak government will.
Yeah, and
or a theocracy.
Although Bush is right that a stable democracy tends not to breed terrorism, but the way that you bring about a stable democracy is not at the barrel of a gun.
Right, and even we have. I mean, look at Tim McVeigh, like you bring up a lot of times. You know, there are or the IRA. I mean, democracies do breed. You know, it
is possible for terrorists to exist within a democracy. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The last point is he said that our troops would leave the day after the mission is done. Well, what about the permanent bases?
Yeah, why are we building 17 bases? Why are we spending more on our embassy there? It's going to be the largest embassy in the world, $1 billion we're going to spend on it. More on the embassy there than we're going to spend rebuilding the World Trade Center. I mean, this is incredible. Pat, thanks very much for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Matt in Kansas on the line. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Tom, something I've become aware of in the last couple of days, and you may know all about this already. My girlfriend is a high school teacher in Hutchinson, Kansas. Two of her counterparts have already accepted invitations from the federal government to take free trips to Las Vegas, Nevada. While they are in Las Vegas, Nevada, they're going to visit a big Air Force base there. And the whole idea behind this is for them to be able to come back and discuss federal government military service with their students.
Yeah, this is part of the full court press that this administration is doing. They are also to get people into the military, to get young people into the military. They've also, because the government is forbidden by law from intrusively collecting data on its citizens, they have hired private corporations to do that. They're not
right.
forbidden by law to do it, and they're buying the information from these private corporations. And now I read this on the air a week or two ago, the story of this one family whose son was contacted by a recruiter and virtually kidnapped. I mean, it's taken off to another city. You know, kept up all night long. Did talked into, you know, here, take this test, and you got to sign these papers to take this test. Just an aptitude test. That's all it is. And he didn't realize that as signing the papers, he was joining the military. You know, all these multi-page documents and lots of fine print. Oh, don't worry, you don't have to read that. Just sign here. And it just the effort that is going into it. And why? Because Americans, unless they are desperate in their poverty, or unless they've just, you know, unless they're facing the conviction of a felony and they want to join the military to get out of that, which is something that, you know, a remnant from the Vietnam era, I remember that well, by and large, Americans don't want to participate in an unjust, inappropriate war that we've been lied into, where there's a good chance that they'll get shot at. Matt, thanks a lot for the call. It's a good point you make. I appreciate it. Lynn in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
I hope I can word this well. I agree with you on that the rights of the reporter should be protected. I'm really having a hard time talking here. I think it's essential that they can protect their sources.
Right.
However, I think that we could, and I know it's not the law now, but maybe we could change it so that the sources are protected if they are whistleblowers, that kind of thing. But not government, you know. Not if the leak was.
See, as soon as you put an if into it, you blow up the First Amendment, basically, Lynn. And this is, I mean, there are many cases where we say which is more important to have, for example, democracy in the United States, where you know that people who are considered innocent until they're proven guilty, or is it more important to catch this particular criminal?
Yeah,
I mean, that was the Miranda case. They let a guy go who I think was, at my recollection is, he was a killer, because he hadn't been told his rights before he was interrogated.
And I
am willing to have a few bad things happen as a consequence. You know, a few mistakes being made as a consequence of the press being free and having these kinds of protections that 49 states now have passed these shield laws. And have the press be there as that fourth estate. You know, the founders really envisioned government as being four parts. There was the executive branch, the president. There was the judicial branch, the judiciary, the Supreme Court, whatnot. The legislative branch, the House and Senate, and the press.
I agree with everything you're saying. Absolutely. The difference I'm trying to make, and it's a very subtle difference, is if it's the government that's doing the leaking, if it's the government that's planting the story, that then it's not, the government is not protected.
But see, the press doesn't protect people, is not required to protect people. I mean, if the government is leaking a story, and in fact it's the press that blew the whistle on the government on these phony press releases. We now have more than 30 government institutions that are generating phony press releases, many of them done by Ken Tomlinson's new hire over at the Corporation for Republican Broadcasting, the new chairman, the new chairperson. There's a woman who's the new chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, was supervising the production of some of these video press releases or participating in some way in them. I mean, and it's the press that blew the whistle on this, that revealed this.
And the press did the right thing. What I'm talking about is the people that are being locked up for not revealing a government source who's giving us a government story.
Right.
Okay. So I think that the government should not be protected under this, you know.
I don't think anybody should be protected under it.
I guess I'm wording it wrong. You know, I think that the press ought to have to reveal their sources if the source is the government propagandizing.
I disagree, because then you're going to have, somebody's going to have to sit down and decide, okay, is this propaganda or is this actual news? And that person may have a partisan agenda, and then you're going to have the press be subject in some cases to going to jail and in other cases not. And they won't know in advance which case it is, and you're going to end up with people in the press saying, I'm not going to take a chance. I don't want to go to jail. It's got to be all or nothing. That's how it works in a democracy. When you're talking about liberty, there, you know, it's not, it's like pregnancy. You can't be a little bit pregnant. Kevin in Buford, Georgia on the line. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? A couple of points I wanted to make real quick. Most importantly, and I heard this on another show, so it's not an original idea. We better start looking out for, as the coming elections, the 206 elections, for the warnings, you know? the terrorist warning.
You're talking about the next attack on America, that the next 9/11 that will catapult Bush through the 2006 elections and his party through the 2008 elections.
And we have to be, because what he's done is, obviously, we haven't had one since he was elected, and that's to show that he's such a great guy. And now we're going to have to start ramping him up, the Republicans, so that they can start saying, well, you have to reelect my people because, really, we're in danger.
Here's the thing, Kevin, that causes me to think that that is absolutely a possibility, and it's not in the realm of the tinfoil hat conspiracy theorists.
No, not at all. And that is that
before 9/11, when these guys were trying to get the Patriot Act passed, was it before or after 9/11?
After 9/11.
It was after 9/11. Thank you very much. Right after 9/11, when they were trying to get the Patriot Act passed, all of a sudden we had the anthrax attacks. And the only people that were attacked by the anthrax killers, the only politicians, were Democrats who were opposed to the Patriot Act. It was Pat Leahy, who was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Tom Daschle, who was the head of all the Democrats in the Senate. And they were the ones who were going to stop the Patriot Act. And all of a sudden, they have anthrax in their offices. And we still have no idea who the anthrax killer is. There is no discussion about the anthrax killer. The federal government, is, as far as I can tell, that makes me wonder, you know, is it possible that they know something that we don't know? And just, you know, the fact that we know that this government has discussed having, you know, staging domestic attacks inside the United States and using them as an excuse for war. We know that during the LBJ administration, they lied about the Gulf of Tonkin incident, about our being attacked, and used that as a pretext for war. Yeah, exactly. We know that during the McKinley administration, Mark Hanna, who Karl Rove calls his role model, said that the U.S., you know, the attack on the U.S.S. Maine, the boiler in the USS Maine blew up, and Mark Hanna said, and it was just an explosion, I mean, it was a mechanical failure, and Mark Hanna said, no, we've been attacked by the Spanish, and that got us into the Spanish-American War, and Hanna was very clear that the only reason he wanted to do that was to increase McKinley's political capital back in 1898, and so it's not like it's never been done before. And that's why I am very concerned about it. I share your concern, Kevin.
So we have to be on top of it, because when they start doing it, and they're going to start doing it, we on the left have got to start saying, wait a minute, come on.
Well, it's not just we on the left. That's we all across America. We have to say, hey, we're up to your game. And, you know, let's deal with this appropriately. And at the very least, let's deal with it appropriately. Let's, you know, and as soon as people start talking about conspiracy theories, I tell you, if an attack happens, the first person who comes out and says, oh, maybe Bush is behind this, or maybe, you know, they're going to be totally marginalized. But the two points to make are, number one, we had a terrorist attack on the Clinton administration, actually two of them. The World Trade Centers were bombed, and Clinton had just come into office. And he wasn't running around like Bush is, going, oh, it was the previous president's fault. No, they found the bomber. They found, you know, the blind sheikh, and they threw his butt in jail, number one. And number two, we had Tim McVeigh, and they caught him, and they threw his butt in jail, and ultimately executed him. And we got closure. I was like, okay, end of discussion. We nailed these guys. Use the criminal justice system. We have an international Interpol system. We could have had Saddam. We could have had Osama bin Laden. See, George Bush has got me doing it too. We could have had Osama bin Laden so long ago, and thrown him in jail. But instead, no. Bush wanted to have a war because he would get political capital from it. Scott in Griffith, Indiana, on the line. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you. First time listener, first time caller.
Great. Thank you.
Yep. All right. A couple things. I totally agree with the last caller. I think the next election is going to make or break the future of this country.
I agree. Well, the next two elections, I'd say.
Okay.
And I'm expecting, if not a terror attack, I'm expecting a war with Syria before the 2006 election and a war with Iran before 2008. The only problem is they don't have the ability to make war anymore because Bush has so badly screwed up Iraq.
Well, here's the thing, and this is totally off topic, but I look for Bush to try to start, maybe I wouldn't call it a war, but this is going to be, there's going to be some type of a situation where religion is going to be at the forefront of everything.
Sure.
If you look at it, I don't know if you've heard of these two cases, but being a non-Christian, this makes me absolutely disgusted. There's a family in Indianapolis, a couple that had just got, or that is in divorce proceedings, And the judge there ruled that they cannot allow their kids to be exposed to their religion, which happens to be paganism.
That's right. Actually, it was Wicca, and I covered that on this program. And both of them are Wiccans, and they both wanted to raise their child in that religion. And they came out and they said, well, this is not devil worshiping. This is, you know, respecting the earth and, you know, the following the seasons and summer solstice and spring solstice and all that kind of stuff. And the judge said that the child had to be raised in a mainstream religion, specifically Christianity, because he's going to a Catholic Church. His parents had sent him to a Catholic school. His parents had sent him to that school simply because they thought he'd get a better education there. Yep. The judge ruled that he had to go to that school. Yeah, absolutely. I've talked about that in this program.
Okay,
and both
another,
the parents
now
wanted
another
him.
Thing. I happen to be pagan, which pretty much, I mean, there's some differences between that and Wicca, but there's some similarities to it as well. There was a couple in South Carolina where the cops had pulled them over because of their bumper stickers, which said, it's a druid thing. The cop wound up arresting the guy for driving while suspended, whatever, fine, he did that, understood. What he did was inappropriate, was he questioned the couple about their religious practices. Then on top of that, sent them a letter to their home saying that their beliefs were wrong and that they needed to convert to Christianity and everything else.
Yeah.
And things like this are happening, obviously, you never heard about this under Clinton or anybody else. But ever since Bush and his, you know, religious friends have taken over, this is all we're hearing. And I'm more scared of anything. Is it going to go back to Salem?
I think we are heading in that direction. I mean, that's certainly the kind of thing that Tony Perkins would love. That's absolutely the direction. Yeah, start hanging those witches again. That was by Ben Franklin left Massachusetts. He was enough of that, you know, enough of the hanging the witches already. He was going down to Philadelphia where it was a little more secular, as they say, which means not anti-religious. Religion was welcomed. It means you actually have government that's about government. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Forces of the world unite. Let us save the day.
Yes, bosses, we need you.
Malcontents without 5 cents want us to cut our pay.
How dare those workers?
We only make 500 times as much as our average worker drones. We work just as hard, and we too sometimes need to paint our home.
Yes, indeed.
The pressures are incredible, and no one seems to care. We moved our plants to Haiti, and now we have to move from there.
The problems that the bosses of the world have, so it's just so difficult for them. It is such a tough time. I got to say, by the way, our last caller talking about the influence of religion in politics in the United States, speaking as a Christian, I'm offended by the hijacking. Frankly, what I see is the hijacking of religion by politics. This is a big debate that James Madison and Thomas Jefferson had throughout most of their lives. Back in the late 1700s, early 1800s, Jefferson was concerned, both of them were in favor of a separation of church and state. Jefferson was concerned that if the churches got power, that they would corrupt the government. And this was, Ben Franklin was very concerned about this too, because he'd seen it in his childhood. He came from Massachusetts. And in fact, under Jefferson's watch as president, one of the big crises was in the first couple of years, the early 1800s, Massachusetts talking about seceding from the Union, because they wanted to become a Christian nation, a Christian state. Massachusetts wanted to become, you know, go back to its Puritan roots and start a theocracy and put the priests in charge and say you could only be elected to office if you had been certified by the priests. And Jefferson had to threaten them with the same kind of thing at Shays' Rebellion that George Washington put down and say, you do that, we'll bring the militia in. So Jefferson was afraid that the church folks would take over the state. Madison, on the other hand, had a different concern. When Congress appropriated money for the poor to give to churches in Washington, D.C., to take care of the poor in Washington, D.C., Madison vetoed it. It was the first veto of his presidency, as I recall, it was in 1812 or thereabouts, 1813. In any case, 1810. Madison vetoed that, and the reason he gave for vetoing it was he said, if money is given from government to churches, it will corrupt religion. It will corrupt the churches. And frankly, as I said, you know, speaking as a Christian, my concern is that my religion is being corrupted by the Republican Party. I don't think Christians have taken over the Republican Party. I think Republican operatives like Pat Robertson have taken over Christianity and or a sect of it, a cult within it. And it really concerns me. And I don't think it's good for this country. I don't think it's good for Christianity or any religion, religion in general. It's certainly not good for democracy. So the last caller, you raised an important point, a good point, one that's worth revisiting. I'll be getting back to your calls after the break. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by restoring democracy to the USA.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Stars and icons. How do we deal with them? Tom Cruise, Bob Dylan. Tom Cruise and Bob Dylan. Well, first of all, Tom Cruise. Here, Andy Borowitz, theborowitzreport.com. Tom Cruise bids farewell to Earth. Perhaps you didn't catch this little news story. Actor Tom Cruise stunned the worlds of cinema and space travel today, bidding Earth farewell forever as he returned to his planet of origin. At the launch pad on the outskirts of Malibu, constructed specifically for his intergalactic journey, Mr. Cruise spoke briefly to friends, well-wishers, and Larry King, who was covering the launch for CNN. "Farewell, Earthlings," Mr. Cruise told the crowd. "My work here is done." The actor then engaged in a 20-minute-long kiss with his fiancée, Katie Holmes, whom he said he would send for later. Boarding the spaceship, Mr. Cruise delighted the crowd with thumbs-up gesture that he immortalized in the film Top Gun, then told him, "I feel the need for speed," before disappearing into the stratosphere. While many had expected Mr. Cruise to return to his home planet at some point, the timing of his departure took many by surprise, coming as it did on the eve of the debut of his summer blockbuster War of the Worlds. Executives at Paramount Pictures, who produced the film, expressed concern that Mr. Cruise's departure from the solar system would limit his availability to appear on late-night talk shows. But according to Buddy Schlontz, a veteran talent agent and observer of the Hollywood scene, Mr. Cruise's decision to return to his planet before the film's opening may be a master stroke. Schlontz said, "If Tom Cruise wanted to do something to make himself more popular, leaving Earth forever was a great place to start." Speaking of stars and icons, this one from my generation, Bob Dylan. Has Bob Dylan finally sold out?
Are the wheels still in spin?
Or sold out once again?
No telling who that it's naming, but the loser now will be later to win for the time.
So Bob Dylan distributing his music, an old CD, or an old recording actually, now a brand new CD of a recording that was done many, many years ago, back in the 60s in a coffee shop in New York. It's going to be distributed apparently through Starbucks. And a lot of liberals, progressives, old hippies, whatever, are having a real problem, and by the way, I fit into all three categories, are having a real problem with this. They're saying, "What? Bob Dylan? You know, Starbucks? The guy is selling out. We can't tolerate that." Well, I want to say, here's my take on this. Bob Dylan was an artist. I don't believe that Bob Dylan ever saw himself, and he keeps saying this over and over, by the way. I don't think that he ever saw himself as the leader of a movement. He wasn't like Martin Luther King trying to change society. He was instead pointing out what he saw in society and parodying it and ridiculing it and holding it up for us to look at and attacking it occasionally. But that's what artists do. That's what good artists do. From Andy Warhol back to Beethoven, good artists highlight what's going on. Well, perhaps Beethoven isn't the best example, but good artists highlight what's going on in society, talk about it in a way that, you know, brings into the public consciousness. On the other hand, there, you know, protest leaders, people who are out to change the world, the Martin Luther Kings of the world, yeah, it's a whole different thing. And I just think, you know, Bob Dylan was always an artist. And one of the things, one of the realities is that art is not a particularly profitable thing. It's very difficult to make your living as an artist. And historically, artists were supported because the arts were viewed as a necessary and important part of culture. Artists were supported by royalty. Beethoven, Bach, Brahms, all those guys, the only way that they could produce their music was with commissions from kings and lords and popes and stuff like that, from the wealthy. Well, nowadays there is a popular culture that buys this kind of music. I mean, back in the 1600s, the average person had no interest in listening to Beethoven. Most music was local. It was in a local bar. It was the local barn dance, whatever, you know, people with fiddles and things or whatever, you know, whatever musical instrument. Hey, kazoos, harmonicas, singing. And it was free. It wasn't a way of making a living. So I defend Bob Dylan's right to do this. That's the bottom line. Bob Dylan, as an artist, wants to make money with his art. I say fine. And if he wants to distribute it through Starbucks, I say fine. I do have a problem with Starbucks not offering free trade or fair trade coffee for brewed coffee. Now, they are offering it for sale. You want to buy a pound of it, you can buy a pound of it. And if you ask them to brew it, in many of their stores, they will brew it, but it's a big hassle. I think, you know, they have the ability to really change the coffee market, the coffee industry worldwide, and they're not taking that change. It is a company that has a little more socially responsible message than most and treats its employees fairly well. I congratulate them for that. But, you know, there are people who I think have some legitimate concerns and criticisms of Starbucks, and they're all upset that Dylan has sold out. I don't think so. But, you know, if you have a different opinion, let me know. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartmann.com, our website, if you want to drop in and hang out on in the live chat room, participate with some of the finest minds on the entire Internet, all of cyberspace, you're perfectly welcome to. And Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hey, what's going on? First of all, thanks for showing up here in Grand Rapids. Hope there was a good turnout, and I wasn't able to come because, as usual, some of us workers had to hold it down.
There you go. Well, I appreciate you doing that. We had a great time, Jason, and after I got off the air, we had a reception that you know, was sponsored by the union there and UFCW, and I gave a little speech, and we just had a lot of fun. I met a whole lot of people. It was wonderful.
Yeah, my dad really appreciated the little bit of time that you were able to sit down and chat and all that. So,
oh, great, great.
You know, We already knew that you were the real deal, so that just kind of cemented.
Well, thank
and
you.
Hopefully you can get out and, you know, across the country and hopefully wake up, you know, enough people to make a difference.
Well, we're working on it. So what's on your mind, Jason?
Yeah, anyway, just a lot of different stuff, but I think the main thing is just kind of encapsulating what a lot of the other callers were saying earlier is that basically a lot of Americans, I mean, contemporarily, we're too far removed from tyranny. It's been too long since, you know, we've been under, you know, the oppression of, like, a tyrannical rule. And, you know, we've gotten complacent, you know, lazy. We don't even appreciate, you know, the hard work that goes into maintaining a democracy.
Yeah, the last tyranny, actually, that we experienced here in the United States was economic tyranny. And Franklin Roosevelt spoke about it specifically. He talked about economic tyranny. And that was, you know, during the Great Depression and during the 1880s through the 19-teens. And it's been a long time, as you say. I think that we got comfortable, and that's a good point, Jason. There are some folks who say, you know, hey, a Great Depression would be a fine thing. It's what we need because it'll cause people to wake up and pay attention and get involved in politics. I say, you know, God forbid. I don't want there to be a Great Depression. And at the same time, it sure looks like George Bush is trying to bring us one. I mean, these guys, they are working so hard to destroy our economy so that they can use that as an excuse to do away with all those horrible programs that they consider to be socialist, like Social Security, Medicare, unemployment insurance, workplace protections, laws that say that, you know, if you maternity leave laws, pensions for the elderly. Health insurance, you know, universal health. They just want to make sure none of the stuff that they consider to be socialist will ever happen. And the stuff that, Franklin Roosevelt put into place. And the Republicans have been trying to take this apart ever since the 1930s. And they hope to succeed. Bonnie in Pittsburgh on the line. Hey, Bonnie, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. I wanted to pay tribute to the great Civil War historian Shelby Foote, who died Tuesday.
Yes.
Yeah, he provided
at the age of 80-something, 82, 88.
Yes, he provided many great narrative snippets to Ken Burns' 1990 Civil War documentary.
Yes.
But the best one, I think, that translates to all military invasions and occupations like we are in Iraq was the one where he was describing two soldiers, one Yankee and one rebel, conversing in some sort of neutral situation, and the Yank asks, "Why are you fighting so hard?" And the rebel said, "Because you're here."
Yeah.
I think that's the motivation behind the vast majority of Iraqis who want the United States out of their country.
It's what the Vietnamese said to us.
Yeah.
And we were saying, oh, you know, if we get out of Vietnam, we can't leave Vietnam, because if we leave Vietnam, horrible things will happen. There will be, the country will be in chaos. There will be centuries of civil war. They're going to knock over their neighbors as a domino. And we left Vietnam, and yes, there was a short and apparently not so dramatic spasm of, you know, arresting people who've been on the other side, which frankly happened after the Civil War in the United States to some extent also, although Lincoln did as much as he could to prevent that from happening. Local communities very often took the law into their own hands. But, you know, basically they got back to work. That's what happens when invaders leave. People get back to work. We kicked out the British. We got back to work. The British said, "Oh, those terrorists, those American terrorists, we can't allow you. They're going to take Canada next." No, we got back to work.
That's right. I agree, because it's the same kind of excuse about these free trade agreements that, you know, those people need jobs, like as if they're sitting around doing nothing.
Yeah.
It's the most ridiculous
thing. No, you have a situation in Iraq where we have an unemployment rate that is, depending on whose numbers you're using, somewhere between 25% and 50%, and the only way that we're able to get people into the military is by offering about four times how much pay.
Yeah. Well,
excuse me.
That's okay.
I ate a cracker here during the break, and it's stuck in my throat.
Hate us for our freedom, is what I wanted to say.
Very well said, Bonnie. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Boy, don't ever eat crackers during a break when you're on the air. Marshall in Virginia on the line. Hey, Marshall, what's up?
Not much, Tom. How are you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better.
I like that.
Especially with a sip of water here. So what's on your mind?
I actually, first of all, I want to say I feel proud because I was one of the millions of people that jumped on the MoveOn.org movement to get them to not cut funding for NPR.
Yes.
And, I mean, honestly, it was a good little victory. I think it would have felt a whole lot better had we felt it on November 5th, but, you know, it's got to start small.
Yeah.
But I was listening to a...
I got to say, though, Marshall, I don't think that this is a victory. It's like maybe this is a battlefield victory, but the war is far from over. The conservatives, in fact, I think this is a diversion, and I'm not criticizing MoveOn.org at all for this. But I think that we have to recognize what the conservative strategy is. They are not trying to kill NPR. They're cutting funding. It's the obligatory thing, yeah. But instead, they don't want to kill it. They want to take it over. They want to control it. They see it as a new and powerful propaganda arm for government. And they're right. It could be. And that's their real agenda. And nobody's talking about that. Nobody's addressing. There are very few people who are talking about that. You got Ken Tomlinson, the head of this thing. He's talking about, you know, he might as well be talking about renaming it the Corporation for Republican Broadcasting. They just hired the co-chairperson of the Republican Party to be the CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The person who was supervising the production of these phony videos, these video news releases, VNRs, video news releases. It's propaganda. Congress has ruled, the Congressional Oversight Agency, General Accountability Office, has ruled that these things are illegal propaganda. The White House says we're going to continue doing them. Tough luck. So, you know, I got to say, Marshall, I think that this was only, you know, it was only a battle. It wasn't the war. So it's a tough one. Marshall, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. We got to move along here. I'm sorry we're out of time on this break. 20 minutes past the hour. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman program, the blue pill, of course.
Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
So long, honey, baby, where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, baby, so I just say fairly well.
Yeah, would you buy a Bob Dylan CD in a Starbucks? Interesting question. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Orange Man in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Orange.
How you doing? Honor and pleasure to be on your show here.
Well, it's an honor and pleasure to have you calling in. What's up?
I feel like I've just been shot with a rush of adrenaline here.
Okay. Probably have been. Happens to me every time I open the microphone.
I learn a lot from listening to you, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have two questions for you. When and who will lead the impeachment proceedings against Benedict Bush? Because I'm just tired of being lied to over and over, and I believe that the person that starts this proceeding against this president will become our next president.
Well,
who do you think it would be?
It'll be John Conyers. It'll be in 2007, right after the January of 2007, after the Democrats are take the oath of office in the first week of January, after the November 2006 elections, and the Democrats take back either the House, the Senate, or both. And I believe it'll be John Conyers, and he has no desire whatsoever to be president, but he is one of a handful of true statesmen in our government, and a truly good and honorable man.
And I remember the one caller mentioned about in order for them to get to keep the White House, they'd have to start a war in Iran. If that happens, they would probably have to have a draft, and I think if they'd have a draft, I think that would be the beginning of the end.
Yeah,
because they just
absolutely
showed to the world that we don't have it. We can't do
absolutely
it.
Absolutely. And that's a whole other topic, although I have to say, and that's the reason why I think we should have a draft, and that we should always have a draft. I think that we should have compulsory military, not military service, compulsory service, a one-year program. You can work in a hospital, you can work any kind of institution, a tree farm, or you can go into the military. And I know that separates me from a lot of folks on this side, but I really think that that's a good thing. I lived in a country in Germany for a year where they do that, and I've spent a lot of time in other countries where they do that, and it really builds a sense of, hey, we're in this all together. People really get it, that there is something about the commons and about common community, and I think that's without that, what you end up with is the rich versus the poor. You end up with the rich making the decisions to go to war and the poor fighting the wars. And that was why Thomas Jefferson argued for compulsory national service as well. He said, we don't ever want to be in a situation where we have pauper hirelings willing to be shot at for a sixpence.
That draft act. They'll always find a way to get out of it.
Well, that's why I said, make it a national service program. Mm-hmm. If somebody doesn't want to go to the war, let them work in a hospital. Let them build bridges. There's so much of America that needs to be rebuilt. There's so much that needs to be done in this country. To give 1 year of your life to your country, to me, seems like an appropriate thing. But in any case, John Conyers is the ranking Democrat, the number one Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee. If the House of Representatives is taken back by the Democrats, he will become the senior member of the House Judiciary Committee, and that's where articles of impeachment would begin. And he's already, said that he's willing to look into this.
It sounds good.
So he would be the man, John Conyers from Michigan, and he's a great man.
Thank you for your time, and stay strong.
You're welcome. Thank you. You too, Orange. I appreciate the call. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Alan in Atlanta. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Oh, not much, Tom. Just hooked up my Sirius satellite radio a couple of days ago, and there you were.
Okay.
What about you, man?
Yeah, good.
Don't worry about your razor sharp. I want your opinion on a couple of things.
Okay, Alan.
Liberals' radio has nobody's embraced this eminent domain decision on either side, and I mean I can certainly understand why from a property rights standpoint. But let me ask you: is it possible that under the circumstances, what the liberal wing of the court's trying to do is for some jobs? Hello, where are the jobs? Is that?
I don't think so. No.
You don't think so?
No. I've read parts of the decision now. I still haven't. I mean, the thing came down last week, and I was saying, I'm going to take the time, or maybe it was Monday. I don't know. It was last week, and I was saying, I'm going to take the time to sit down and read this. I haven't yet, frankly, had an opportunity to read the entire decision. But what I have read of it, I have read good chunks of it, and the various opinions around it, and the arguments. I read some of the arguments leading up to it. Is that really what the court decided? It did two things. Number one, they actually increased the power of local communities to say no to eminent domain. So while they increased the power of local communities to say yes to local domain, to eminent domain, they also increased the power of local communities to say no, number one, which might be a good thing. And number two, they just put into law what's been going on all along. I mean, the way that George W. Bush became a multimillionaire was by eminent domain, you know, the Texas Rangers. I'll tell you about that right after this. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Where despair is not an option, get active, my friends. As I was mentioning at the end of the last segment, just before we went into the break, the way that George W. Bush became a millionaire. Now, he was born, of course, with a multimillion-dollar trust fund. He was born into one of the most wealthy and powerful families in America, the Walker family. His mother's family and the Bush family, two, you know, political and economic dynasties, you know, with a mansion in Connecticut, a mansion in Maine. He was, of course, born in Connecticut. He went to school, prep schools, Andover Prep School on the Northeast. He went to Harvard and Yale. He's a scion of the elite, right? I mean, there you go. There he is. However, he wanted to make his own mark. He wanted to go out and make money on his own. And so he started Arbusto, which stands for it means shrub in Spanish, Arbusto Oil Company. And it went bust. So he sold it out. He big sweetheart deal with some friends of his father's, sold it out to Harkin Energy. And then he was running our Harkin Energy, and he was on the board, and Harkin Energy was about to go bust. And so he gets bailed out by Salman bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's half-brother. And Salman bin Laden dies in a plane crash in Texas a few years later when the Democrats start looking into this. Strange coincidence, but just a coincidence, no doubt. And Osama's half-brother. And then Bush gets another deal, the Texas Rangers. They're going to offer him, as I recall, it was a 1.8% share in the Texas Rangers for only $600,000+, roughly $600,000, $600,000 to $700,000. So he borrows the money. See, keep in mind, he hasn't made any money along. Every one of his businesses has failed miserably, and he's had to be bailed out by his father's friends. He borrows some money from one of his father's friends, gets into this thing, and the Texas Rangers then cut a deal with the city of Arlington, Texas, where the city sells $135 million worth of bonds. In other words, the city borrows $135 million to build a stadium. And then they go to a bunch of people in town and say, whose homes are where they want to build the stadium, and say, you guys are out. And these people, and one of them, there's one particular family, said, no, we're not going. And the city said, yes, you are. And they said, no, we're not. And the city said, yes, you are, eminent domain. We got the Texas Rangers. They're going to come in here. It's a for-profit corporation, and they're going to run baseball games out of here in our stadium. And they succeeded. And the family, I reported the name of the family last week. It's not at the tip of my tongue. And the family sued, and they won $5 million. Plus $1,000 a day interest. And by the time Bush sold out of the Rangers, now once the Rangers had their stadium, they were worth infinitely more money. Not infinitely, massively, much more money. So his stake in the company is now worth $14.5 million. He sells it, he pays off the original $600,000 loan, and poof, George is now a millionaire businessman. A successful businessman in his own right. He finally has a little bit of self-esteem, decides to quit drinking and go into politics. And run for governor, right? And this, here it is, eminent domain. So in many ways, the Supreme Court was simply ratifying what's so. But again, I'm not defending it. I think it was an absolutely wrong decision. They had an opportunity to say no. And to call, by the way, to call the folks who voted for this the liberal wing of the court is just absurd. There is no liberal wing to this court. There is none. None whatsoever. There are some moderates on this court. Some moderate Republicans, three out of the five justices who voted to give eminent domain rights, via local municipalities, state and state governments to multinational corporations, essentially, for all practical purposes. Three out of those five justices were appointed by Republican presidents. I'm sorry, there's just no liberals on the court. There are a couple of moderates, and then there are a couple of old-fashioned Republicans, and then you got three or four, well, three specifically, Rehnquist, Souter, and Thomas, excuse me, Rehnquist, Thomas, and Scalia, three right-wing extremists. I mean, extreme extremists, particularly Scalia and Thomas. And these guys want to take us back to before the Civil War. Anyhow, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Xavier in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Xavier, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I wanted to address a woman called in yesterday about taking back the media. But real briefly, quick before that, I wanted to talk about NPR. You were saying what had happened in the 70s is they got together with the National Association of Broadcasters and started basically pushing out all of these small college stations, low-wattage stations,
yeah,
and taking them under the wing of the NPR group and basically making it ripe for takeover.
Yeah.
You know, they've all this little independent thing. So that's the point I wanted to make on that. As far as taking back the media, there's a lot of things.
Let me just add to that, by the way. You know, when I left Vermont, Vermont Public Radio had bought up all of the local public radio stations all over the state. So basically it was a monopoly.
Right.
And the guy who is the head of Vermont Public Radio is a, shall we say, a Republican.
Uh-huh.
Or at least a strong church-going conservative. And that's not to conflate the two, by the way. There's a lot of good church-going liberals. But in any case, he very much wanted to have nothing but classical music on during the day, no political programming whatsoever, and so they don't have any. And there was a year-long campaign to try and get Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman's program, on Vermont Public Radio, and he absolutely refused to allow it to happen. And so a local station in Vermont, which carries this program, by the way, WDEV in Waterbury, Vermont, picked up Amy Goodman's show, and it's a one-hour show, you know, Democracy Now!, and it's not a commercial show, but there are a couple of pauses in there, and they take those pauses, they expand them out, they drop commercials in the middle of them, they turn it into an hour and 15-minute commercial program, and they're running at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and all over Vermont, people are tuning into a commercial station now and tuning out of Vermont Public Radio. So there, And National Public Radio, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, also has in many ways worked against low-wattage FM stations, which I'm totally in favor of. I think communities in low-wattage FM should be out there, and NPR has fought against those politically.
Hey, Tom, before I run out of time, I want to make my main point, okay?
Okay, make your main point.
Okay. Well, there's three things that I can think of off the top of my head. One is community television stations, cable access. A lot of times you can go down there and get information on how to run a camera and do your own show.
Yep.
Another thing you can do is I came from a very rural town in Michigan, and I called up the library there and asked them about if they had any books by Tom Hartman. They have your ADD books, but they've never heard of any of the other things, so I sent them off an email with some suggestions.
Oh,
that's the second thing.
Good on you. Okay.
And the third thing, this is a biggie here, is here in Santa Cruz, we have a radio station called Freak Radio Santa Cruz and .org, and it's a pirate radio station. It's not licensed. We've been on the air for 10 years. Just recently was the first time the FCC has finally come in and raided us, and we went right back on the air, and we haven't been bothered for about 8 months now.
That's great. The same thing happened in either Brattleboro, in Brattleboro, Vermont. Radio Free Brattleboro got shut down. People that I know, I spoke at a benefit for them a couple of years ago, and they're having a terrible time now with the FCC. So the FCC is really starting to crack down on these pirate radio stations.
Well, the key is to keep your, this is like, I want to put in a plug for anarchism here. It's about personal responsibility. If you take, you have to be responsible. You can't walk on somebody else's signal. You have to have a clean signal, phase-locked loop, filtered signal. And then you have to address the free speech issues because you're not interfering with anyone else.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Xavier, at all. And I think it's a great point that you made, and I thank you for making it. Although I have to say, I really think that what you're seeing, it's just like, when you see, you know, during Prohibition, when you saw all these guys, you know, bathtub gin and bootleg whiskey, the reason why? Because people wanted to drink. I mean, there's a market for something. People are going to create it, even if it's illegal. There's a market for small community radio. There is demand for small community radio, and the FCC has the means to facilitate it by allowing low-wattage FM, low-wattage AM for that matter, but in particular low-wattage FM, because FM signals tend to be line-of-sight signals, so they're within the community. Community low wattage community radio make it easy. You know, you can build a low wattage FM station for a couple of $1,000s. And I think that the FCC should be encouraging this. And I think that NPR has done us a big disservice by politically in the back rooms fighting against this over the years, frankly. I don't want to get too much into inside baseball discussions about the radio industry either. Bob in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, to piggyback on this guy's call from Santa Cruz, we're trying to get Democracy Now here in our local station, and they refuse to carry it, so maybe some private station will carry that, and that'd be great if they...
Yeah, tell them to the folks, write down WDEV, and tell them to contact Ken. He's the station manager at WDEV, and he'll tell them how they can do it.
Okay.
He's in Waterbury, Vermont.
All right. What I wanted to talk about was the draft and Iran.
Yep.
You mentioned the last half hour somebody talked about needing a draft, and I agree with you that it should be universal service, but I don't think the military will do that. I think that they will end up having a lot more contractors. I think they will start getting foreigners under the promise of becoming citizens.
Well, we're already doing that.
And I think they're going to start doing diversion programs for some minor criminal behavior.
We're already doing that too. If you're busted for pot, for example,
mm-hmm.
if you're busted for petty crimes, you know, petty larceny, you know, the smaller felonies,
yeah,
shall
you
we
can
say?
Take the option. Okay, I'll go into the service.
That's right. Yeah, that's happening right now, just like it did during Vietnam.
Yep.
We're right back there, and now all of a sudden the Army. The report just came out today. The Army hit their recruiting goals for June. It's not going to be enough for the year. They're not going to be anything close to it, but they did hit their recruiting goals, and you just have to ask, you know, what went into that,
right? And what numbers did they revise down from,
right? And and how much, you know, what kind of recruiting bonuses are they paying people? I mean, it's really pretty startling. Bob, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Tim in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Tim, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hello, Tom. Woke up today and saw C-SPAN, and looks like they're trying to push CAFTA through by the
4th of July.
Yeah, sign it. So it's a call of action for us to write these guys up or
something.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, well, you can call your elected member of Congress, whether it's your congressman or congresswoman, or whether it's your senator, or one of your two. You have two. Everybody has two senators and one member of the House of Representatives. And if you call 1-877, it's toll-free across the United States, 1-877-SOB-USOB. SOB, the letter U-O-S-O-B. It's actually the old Senate office building number, which is how it started out that way. It's a toll-free number that the government does not publicize, but it's been around for a long, long time, ever since it was the toll-free number into the Senate office building. And it now rings at the switchboard of the Capitol, the main switchboard for the Capitol. You can ask for the president's office, the vice president's office, or any elected member of Congress, and tell them, hey, we don't want CAFTA. In fact, don't just stop there. Not only should you defeat CAFTA, but blow NAFTA out of the water, and let's walk away from GATT and the WTO.
One thing I heard, I don't know if it's a true fact, but the countries are going to deal with pertaining to CAFTA have the purchasing power of New Bedford, Connecticut. Totally.
Yeah, New London, Connecticut is what I had heard. Maybe it's New Bedford. I don't know. It's New something, Connecticut. You're absolutely right. The combined purchasing power of the 44 million people in the CAFTA countries. Half of those 44 million people are working for wages right now of less than $2 a day. Less than $2 a day. So how are they going to buy anything from us? Oh, we need to sell them all this. They want to buy all this stuff that we're going to manufacture in America. I don't think so. If they're going to buy any stuff, it's going to be cheap stuff. They're going to buy Walmart stuff. It's going to be made in China. No, what the corporations and the corporatists and their shills in Congress really want, is 44 million potential workers who will work for far less than U.S. minimum wage. Dave in Carbondale, Illinois on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Appreciate what you're doing there. A couple callers ago, you were talking about Conyers initiating some impeachment proceedings if the Democrats take over.
I believe he would do it.
Is
I may be
correct?
Wrong, but I believe he would do it.
I was wondering or thinking that perhaps we don't have to wait that long if we can get Hastert to pull a Macbeth. In other words, talk his constituents into...
Do you know how long he would last? Denny Hastert would suddenly have an accident. Denny Hastert would suddenly, you know, he'd suddenly convert to Islam or something. I mean, there's a lot of things that'll happen long before Denny Hastert comes out for the impeachment of George W. Bush.
Well, I just, he's up for a re-election every 2 years. If we can get his constituency in his district to say, do this or...
Is Hastert out of Illinois or Ohio?
He's up in the western suburbs of Chicago.
Illinois. Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah.
Just a thought. I don't know if we could get that done or not, but it would be certainly quicker than waiting a couple of years for the tide to turn.
Well, you live in Illinois, Dave. You know, give him a shout. Even though he doesn't represent you, he represents your state. Call his office.
I don't know who he represents exactly.
Yeah. Well, give him a call, 1-877-SOB-USOB, and tell him what you think.
Beautiful. Good idea.
Yeah, Dave, thanks a lot for calling. Thanks for listening on WINI there in Carbondale. I do appreciate it. Debbie in Alabama on the line. Hey, Debbie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Same thing about impeachment. Several calls earlier, someone asked you, when is this going to happen? And you said after the 06 elections when the Dems get back into the Senate and or House. Well, I don't know how that's going to happen with the machines. There's more of these voting machines going in. And I have to say I'm disappointed at you. And at all, I love you, Tom. Don't take that wrong. But no one is shouting about this. One person said it's being done on a state-by-state basis. That's not enough. It's got to be
Debbie, let me point out, I wrote the first article over 2 years ago, published on Common Dreams and all over the Internet, revealing the fact that Chuck Hagel used to be the CEO of the company that's now ES&S. I've been shouting about voting machines. I wrote the piece that Alternet, you know, that is now on Alternet, that MoveOn.org mailed out to 1.5 million people a year and a half ago, revealing the secrets of the voting machines. I have been on this, you know, pardon me if I sound defensive here, but I just want you to know, this is a topic that we talk about in this program a lot.
I know it is, but the thing is, it seems that the Democrats, the progressives, why are they not going?
They
out
are trying
on the
as
street?
Hard as they can. They actually have enough co-sponsors to rush Holt's bill to make to require paper trails in the voting machines to get it through the House of Representatives. Tom DeLay and Denny Hastert won't allow it to come to a vote. That's the problem. The Republicans are obstructing. The Democrats are speaking out about it loudly. 10 minutes before the hour. Thanks, Debbie.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Close your eyes, close the door.
And at the Starbucks, and then buy a Bob Dylan CD. No, I'm surprised nobody took the bait there on that one. I defend his right to do it, and I will always buy my coffee locally. What can I say? 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Mike in Easton, Pennsylvania, on the line. Hey, Mike, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for all your work, and want to make a comment about NAFTA, CAFTA.
Sure.
It is probably the same thing that will happen if CAFTA is approved. It's the same thing that happened with NAFTA, in that about the only things we exported to Mexico were jobs
and
also subsidized corn, which ran most of their farmers out of business. And then those farmers have to go work for whatever wages they can get.
Yeah, in the maquiladora factories. And what we did was we increased poverty in Mexico. We made the multinational corporations, the very big, giant factory farm groups that take the huge corn subsidies, wealthy here in the United States. And we impoverished a lot of Mexicans in that process. Plus, we've lost, net, according to government figures, somewhere between 800,000 and 900,000 jobs here in the United States. You know, millions actually went south. Some actually came north. Some came in from Canada. But the net is nearly 1 million jobs that we've lost as a result of NAFTA. And CAFTA will be far worse because the countries to the south of Mexico, a lot of people, easy access to ports. You know, a lot of people living along the seacoasts where you can get goods in and out. It'll be, you're absolutely right, it'll be an absolute disaster. Mike, thanks for the call and thanks for pointing that out. I appreciate it. Is it Kleina in Racine?
Yes, hi.
Hey, Kleina, what's up?
Hi. I have some news that I thought was kind of distressing, actually. This U.S. Senator Herb Kohl from Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
he owns the Milwaukee Bucks professional basketball team.
Right.
And there's talk, and it's never been in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I guess. Joel McNally wrote in the editorial page of our paper that he's been thinking of selling it, and Michael Jordan has been a bidder in it. But what's even more shocking to me was that I guess China wants to be part of that investment.
See, this is the thing. People go to Walmart and they buy all this this cheap stuff made in China, and they think that the money is just going to Walmart. That it's, and of course, it's not staying in their local community. Every night a button gets pushed at midnight, and all that money goes to Bentonville, Arkansas. But then in Bentonville, Arkansas, they ship a good chunk of that money over to China. The Chinese are sitting around with all this American money going, okay, we got all this money that people gave to Walmart. What are we going to do with it? Okay, let's buy a basketball team. Let's buy an oil company. Let's buy a manufacturing company. Let's buy IBM. Let's start making... what have we done? The insane conservative economic policies of this administration are just eviscerating, cutting the guts out of this country. We've got to stop it. The way to stop it is at the ballot box. See you there in November.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border. Welcome back to our program. Our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com if you'd like to drop into our live chat room and participate in one of the most erudite, interesting, fascinating, sometimes even weird conversations on the whole entire internet in real time with actual human beings. 1-866-889-8894. Scott in California on the line. Hey, Scott, been on hold for a bit here. What's up?
Good morning, Tom. Well, I've been reading a lot about vote fraud. I've called in a couple of times about that. I've been following it. And it looks like a programmer that was programming in Florida was instructed specifically to allow the voting program to be hacked into.
Yeah, Clint Curtis. We've had him on this program.
Fascinating, fascinating.
Yeah, and he says that Tom Feeney was the guy who hired him when Feeney was the Speaker of the House in Florida. Feeney, the guy who said in the 2000 election that even if the vote went for Gore, that the House of Representatives in Florida was going to send their electoral votes for Bush to Washington, D.C. Tom Feeney is now a U.S. congressman.
And he has not
denied these charges, by the way.
I read that. I'm reading the Washington Spectator. It's all in there. We've been very active here in San Diego. I know Amy's been calling in. There's another friend of mine named Patrick Taylor who calls in off and on. We've decided we're taking over the clean election movement down here because they're not really doing anything. And Pat and I think like engineers. Let's propose something and get feedback.
There
Let's
you go.
Not get everybody's opinion and then try to put something together. Which
good
is
on you, Scott. Talking. Good on you. And this is what absolutely has to be done. We've got and why can't we have open source software? Why can't we have a voting system that is secure and that does work and that's not run by a corporation that is overtly owned by Republicans? I don't get it. And then for the Republicans among us who want to get nervous, Howard Dean on national TV hacked a Diebold machine. On Topic A with Tina Brown, live. He hacked into a Diebold machine and changed an election in an absolutely untraceable way. Democrats know how to do it, too. In fact, the chairman of the party knows how to do it. Brian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to talk about, I completely agree with you about Bob Dylan. And I just wanted to say, as a professional musician for the past 12 years, it is extremely difficult to make any significant money in music whatsoever without doing something that is sold out one way or the other. Now, did Bob Dylan sell out? I don't think so. I think maybe when, you know, when Bob Dylan cuts a rap or a hip-hop CD, maybe then we have something to worry about.
Then we can complain. Okay. Thanks a lot, Brian. I appreciate it. And you know, you're right. This is it's tough being an artist in the United States. That's the bottom line. Well, it's that time of the week when it's time to consider something that you thought you knew that you didn't know. Maybe you didn't even know that you didn't know. Maybe you didn't know that you needed to know, but you need to know what you don't know because you don't know what you don't know. And how can you know what you don't know if you don't know it? In fact, sometimes...
Know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Are you ready for the next plague? The next plague? Here we have Microbe is the new book. Are you ready for the next plague? And Michael Bellamo is with us. Hey, Michael.
Howdy. How's it going, Tom?
Great. Great. You are the author or co-author of this new book, Microbe. Are we ready for the next plague? Are we?
Yes. Well, as we put it in the book, if you started from scratch, it'd be kind of more difficult to design a worse system than we have right now. We really don't have anything... equivalent to a disease surveillance system, which is what we really need right now to protect us from something else like SARS or a new kind of West Nile showing up on our shores.
In addition to just the public health considerations of this, wouldn't it be rational to do this if in this age of bioterrorism? I mean, here we have the Bush administration spending billions of our tax dollars to make sure that we take our shoes off at the airport and everybody gets athlete's foot. And not, as far as I can tell, one penny on a national monitoring system for infectious diseases.
Not a single penny, and I'll tell you something else you might find interesting, Tom. In the 2006 budget that is on Bush's desk right now, supposedly the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, is the budget has been cut by 9%, and specifically the CDC's Public Health Emergency Fund, which is what funds state and local agencies, helps them prepare for bioterrorism attacks, is going to be cut by 12.6%.
What's going on, Michael? I don't get it. They won't protect our ports. They're not looking at the cargo that's coming in. They're not looking at the cargo in every single airplane that we fly on. They're not looking they opened up the Mexican border so that Mexican trucks can come over the border, most of them without being checked. I mean, it was just this huge thing, and Mexican drivers can drive them all over the United States. The argument there was, well, it's cheap labor. It's good for the multinationals, and that's who Bush loves. But it seems like over and over and over again, these guys are wiping out our ability to protect ourselves against not just terrorist attacks, but just, you know, garden variety things like, gee, another outbreak of SARS or the avian flu or salmonella or West Nile. Why? Why? You know, I understand they got to have tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, but they're also borrowing $2 billion a day to keep the government going. Why can't they borrow $3 billion a day and fund some of this stuff?
Well, between you and me, I personally think that public health, for example, it's just not a glamorous kind of field. This particular administration has a very strange appetite for what I'm going to call your big budget pie in the sky project. For example, they're still going to fund things to help us protect us against a missile shield when we're much more at risk for somebody, say, bringing in a suitcase with a nuclear weapon.
Right, and that's $1 trillion. But it's $1 trillion that's going to old line Republicans, good old friends. I mean, you know, look at Caspar Weinberger and George Shultz. They both worked for Bechtel Corporation. They were in Reagan's cabinet. You know, you can see that this is crony capitalism at its very worst, going way back. But there are folks out there, Michael, who are saying, who are openly suggesting that this administration not only dropped the ball with 9/11, in fact, not only had a pretty good idea that it was coming, they may not have known exactly where or exactly when, but they knew fairly closely. I mean, George Bush had, 56 memos saying Bin Laden was going to hijack planes? I mean, in fact, when he was in Italy for the G8 conference back in, what was it, March of 2001, I believe it was? He was G8. They had to evacuate him from the hotel that he was staying in and put him on an aircraft carrier out in the Mediterranean because the word had come down that Al-Qaeda, that Osama bin Laden, was going to hijack a plane and crash it into the hotel. And then after 9/11, Condoleezza Rice comes out and says, oh, we couldn't have imagined that anybody would ever turn a plane into a missile and hijack it. Come on. They had already evacuated George Bush. So there are people who are looking at that and saying, and frankly, I have to say, you know, I am not in the extreme conspiracy camp to say, you know, George Bush knew what was going to happen, you know, blah, 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 and let it happen intentionally. I think that there was massive incompetence. But there are people who are suggesting that he actually let this happen because he knew it would help him politically, that he could use that as a pretext to invade Iraq, and then that would be the thing that would help the Republicans take the Senate in 2002 and get him reelected in 2004 and get him all that political capital he wants, and that ever since then, they have done at step after step after step, they have refused to do the things that would protect us from the next attack on America because they see political gain in there being another attack on America. Then they can completely shut down democracy in this country. I mean, tell me that I'm being paranoid.
Well, I'm hesitant to endorse any of the conspiracy theories, but I will tell you one extra little bit of information you might find kind of interesting is, again, do you remember in 2001, of course we all focused on 9/11, but also in that period of time, we also had these strange little letters full of anthrax showing up. You may remember that...
They only showed up in the offices of Democrats.
Yeah,
Democrats who were in a position to scuttle a Patriot Act. Pat Leahy was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he was opposed to the Patriot Act, and it had to get through him to get onto the floor of the Senate, and Tom Daschle was the head of the Senate, and he had to approve it for the Senate to vote on it, and those are the two guys who just happened to get anthrax. Yeah.
Correct. And at this point, even when that happened, we still, to this day, do not have some sort of routine surveillance or warning system. If anything like that ever happens again, we're going to have still no idea where it came from, where it's going. We're going to be not going to be able to distinguish from just a natural outbreak of any sort of disease that could crop up, that sort of thing.
Why not?
Well, again, I suspect it's a matter, it depends on whether you decide to side with the folks who say this is an administration that already knows what's going on and has decided not to act on it for political gain, or you have the possibility that you have...
That they're just incompetent.
Yes, well, I'll just going to be generous and say benign neglect. But you have here some rather willful blindness at times where it is simply incomprehensible that even if you didn't know that something was going to happen, now that you've had proof of what really could happen, how disruptive it is, that you still don't get up and actually do something in order to protect us from this sort of thing happening again.
We're talking to Michael Bellamo. He's the author, co-author, along with Dr. Alan P. Zelikoff of Microbe. Are we ready for the next plague? Pardon me, I interrupted you mid-sentence there, Michael. Continue.
No problem, no problem. Basically, what is absolutely amazing is that now we've actually had a little glimpse of exactly how disruptive it is. I don't know about you, but I remember when they were having editorial cartoons every week showing the mailmen showing up in biohazard suits delivering your mail.
Right.
That sort of thing. Is it really that difficult to imagine that this sort of thing could happen again? And if there was something that was simple, inexpensive, and easy to implement that all around the country to help prevent it, wouldn't that be something that's worthwhile having? But no, instead we see billions of dollars wasted on the same types of things, the same short-sightedness, and essentially a lack of action to do anything except for things, like you said, that benefit, I'm gathering, the people who have much better placed lobbyists up on the Hill.
Well, could it be, well, first of all, is it true that to put into place a national biohazard monitoring system, a national infectious disease or, you know, terrorism, bioterrorism attack or whatever, a national monitoring system for this would be inexpensive and relatively easy to do? Is that actually true?
Absolutely, it's true. We were talking for something that could cost anywhere between maybe $10 and $100 million. That is something that is incredible.
That's the amount of money that we spend in Iraq in less than one day.
Easily less than that. And essentially, anybody who you can use a monitoring system by simply utilizing a program that runs over the internet. If you can navigate Internet Explorer, if you know how to get to your website, you can use this. This is not something you need to hire a number of PhDs to run. This is not something that's going to require putting people in.
Well, that's why it's not being done. There's no big multinational corporation with connections to the Bush family that's up on Capitol Hill saying, "Hey, give us $1 billion to do this."
That's true. That's true. It's kind of strange. You would think they would be interested in this. You know, one of the cases we actually outline and talk about in the book where a monitoring system would have come in handy is in Lubbock County, Texas, which is in north central Texas, a bit north of where the Bush Ranch is, of course. There was actually a case where there was a researcher who purported he was missing his vials of plague that he was researching in his laboratory.
Right.
Now, had those actually gotten into the wrong hands and cases of plague started popping up around Texas, we would have no idea whether this was an intentional act, whether it was related to that crime, whether it was simply a natural outbreak. We simply don't know. And what you don't know, you can't respond to effectively.
Michael, we've got about 30 seconds left. Do you see this avian flu thing as big a problem as the World Health Organization seems to see it as?
It's potential. It's unlikely that we have any confirmed reports that there has been human-to-human transmission, but it's something we've got to watch extremely carefully. And if we don't have a warning system in place, it'll be here, and it'll be on your front doorstep before you know it.
Yeah, and the Wall Street Journal ran an article about 6 months ago saying, essentially, if you're a white, rich, male reader of the Wall Street Journal, go out and buy some Tamiflu, because it's the only drug that'll stop this stuff. And now, last week, they had an article saying it now takes 2 years to get your Tamiflu. It's this is a drug that they extract from star anise, which is only grows in China, and all the worldwide supplies are exhausted. Michael Bellamo, am I pronouncing it right, Michael?
Close enough. You're
okay.
Doing good.
Okay, Michael Bellamo, he's the co-author of a new book, Microbe, Are We Ready for the Next Plague? Check it out in a bookstore near you. Thank you so much, Michael, for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
It is appreciated. It is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
My bills are all due, and the babies need shoes, but I'm busted.
Yeah, the Republicans took over, you see.
Cotton is down to a quarter a pound, and I'm busted.
It was Herbert Hoover that time, I think.
I got a cow that went dry, and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that get bigger each day. The county will haul my belongings away. I'm busted.
Yes, indeed. The wonderful world of George W. Bush. Welcome back, and thank you, Johnny Cash, for that. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. We'll be getting to your calls in just a moment. But first, we have Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, with our who is our correspondent from Washington, D.C., Victoria?
You could call me that, yeah.
Okay.
Anything, just, you know, just don't call me silly.
Just don't call you late for dinner, right?
Right, exactly.
So what's up?
Exactly. Well, Washington is definitely getting ready to leave town. You can tell. I always time my commute. You know, I'm one of those obsessive people, and it took less time this morning than yesterday, so tomorrow will be 5 minutes. Although the Senate Appropriations Committee is meeting tomorrow to have a hearing about PBS funding.
Oh, interesting.
That will be lively. Who knows if Big Bird will show up? I mean, you know.
Is anybody from the Senate Appropriations Committee going to show up? Is perhaps a better question.
I think they will. It's at 9:30. They should be able to get a lunchtime plane.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. It's a morning one. Oh, goodness me. Friday afternoon. Tom.
That's what I was thinking. It's like, you know, and it's a holiday. I mean, here in Portland, we got people, you know, already on their way out of town. It's Thursday.
No, absolutely. No, I mean, you know, I was hoping there wouldn't be a hearing, so I wouldn't. But anyway, I've got to go. So there you are.
Yeah.
So we've had that. We've also had the...
We will be live on the air, by the way, both tomorrow and Monday.
Good for you.
So if are you going to be calling in with your report on Monday?
We will not have a report on Monday,
oh,
no.
Okay. All right. You know, bums.
Nothing happening.
Okay. Well, you're right. There won't be anything happening. And, you know, hopefully there won't be anything happening in Washington, D.C.
Well, if there is something major that happens, of course, you will definitely have a report.
Yeah. Okay.
But other than that, you know, the president is getting ready to leave for Denmark and for the G8 summit. We had a briefing this afternoon by Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor, who is very slick, very good in terms of answering the way he wants to answer. He said it's a sad day in, because of the plane down in the chopper down in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
He didn't say much about that, though. I understand at the Pentagon they're also not saying very much either, although 16 bodies apparently were recovered. Hadley would only say basically what McClellan had said this morning with regard to reports that the new head of Iran is basically a former revolutionary.
Right.
That they're looking into it, they don't know
well,
yet.
Well, everybody has a past, I guess. I have a quick question for you, Victoria.
Go on.
One of the things that's happening out in the blogosphere, and there's a photo of this on our message board at tomhartman.com on the AM 620 KPOJ site, is that when Bush was speaking night before last, behind him there were two flags that were folded back so not all of the stars were showing and not all of the stripes were showing. And so that the stars seemed to form a giant nine, and then there were only two stripes to the right of them showing. It was like there was 9/11 on the left of him and 9/11 on the right of him. The flags were actually folded back and desecrated, as it were, in a way that made them look like subliminally like a 9/11. Has there been any discussion about that in Washington, D.C.? Because it's all over the blogosphere right now.
There hasn't been, and I might have been brave enough to ask Scott McClellan about it, although seeing as I'm the only one who's asking about the Downing Street memo, pretty soon they're going to put me in a separate room.
They'll give you a free speech zone outside.
But that's fascinating. I mean, I'd have to see the pictures.
Yeah.
That's
if you want to see the picture, go to TomHartmann.com, click on Message Boards, and then click on the KPOJ Message Board. I just put it up there this morning. You can take a look at it.
That is fascinating. Oh, I'm definitely going.
It's like right behind Bush. It's 9/11, 9/11, 9/11, 9/11. It's incredible.
Well, I mean, it does kind of fit with what was being said in that speech. The number of times 9/11 has been mentioned. And really how badly it's gone down.
And whenever he gives a speech, they put the slogan behind him, usually in words.
Yeah, it's usually words or it's you know, something that's going to make it seem like he's fitting in. I mean, it is extremely staged.
Yeah, everything is with this administration. They don't believe in letting we the people have much interaction. Victoria Jones, thanks so much for your report today.
Thank you.
Always
Bye-bye.
Great to hear from you. Have a good day and a safe travels. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
We're stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Yes, indeed, between a rock and a hard place. Yeah, that's kind of where we're stuck at, isn't it? Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, however you spell it. It's T-H-O-M and Hartmann with two N's, but that doesn't matter. However you spell it will get you to our website, and you can drop into our chat room if you'd like to say hi to some of the finest minds on the entire Internet. And also you can participate in our message board and read the messages there. See the photo of George Bush in front of the 9/11 flags from Wednesday night, or Tuesday night, was it? I guess it was. And on it goes. I have a question. Why do some so-called conservatives so love fetuses but hate fully born humans? You get this about pro-lifers supporting testing pesticides on fetuses? We'll come back to that in just a second. First, 1-866-889-8894, your telephone, our telephone number, Stacy in Arcata, California. Hey, Stacy, what's up?
Not much. I just want to make a quick comment about a personal experience with Bob Dylan.
Oh, okay. That sounds interesting.
Since we're talking about him and people are saying maybe he was selling out or stuff like that about the Starbucks thing. But my mother was running a fundraiser for my sister who was mentally and physically handicapped. And they were trying to purchase some equipment, rehabilitation equipment to for the kids at the school to use. And needless to say, it wasn't going very well. And Bob Dylan was coming into town. And he was listening to a station that they had advertising on, saying, you know, that the fundraiser wasn't going very well. And when he left town, he cut him a check for $50,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good on him.
Pretty much filled their quota. So, I mean, and this is like true giving. Like, this did not fulfill his ego in any way, you know. And, like,
right.
People don't see this. The only people I think know about this are, like, who my mom and I tell.
Yeah. Well, you just told a lot of people about it, so good on you, Stacey.
I'd like to see money in his hands.
Yeah. There you go. He'll use it well. Stacey, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Yep, it's Bob Dylan, our Bob Dylan moment, in fact,
and
yes.
Don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming.
No, there's no telling.
But the loser now will be later. For the times they are changing.
From your lips to God's ears, Bob, hopefully speaking of the political changes, the losers now will then be winning, yes. Irene in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Irene, thanks for calling the Tom Hartman program.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've never called before. I'm 87 years old. I absolutely love your program.
Well, thank you.
Wondering if you have read or heard of the book by David Ray Griffin, The New Pearl Harbor.
Yes, I have it, and I have read it.
Oh, well, my son and I have been reading it, and we are just fascinated by it.
Yeah, it's a little startling.
It is a little startling, but don't you think it's very worthwhile reading?
I do. Although it's important, the caveat that I would give anybody who's reading The New Pearl Harbor by Griffin is that there are a lot of good facts presented in the book, and he documents a lot of them. There are also an awful lot of leaping to conclusions from those facts, and I think that if it was presented in that way, you know, it was presented like if he was to say, okay, we know about A, we know about B, and therefore some would suggest that it's possible that if you have A and you have B, that C could have happened. If he had said, instead what he says in the book is, we know about A, we know about B, and therefore C must be. And, you know, or now that's not a confusing. Therefore, C is a certainty, right? And that's my problem with the book is that they state conclusions as if they were facts, and then they mix them up with the facts. That's not to say, though, that what's said in the book and even the conclusions may not be right, and that's the scary part.
That's the scary part, yeah. As he says, if you read it even with a 30% of an open mind.
Yeah.
You know, it might change. Because I'm old enough to have lived through World War II and the days of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And sometimes I have little questions about that. The original Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the...
Which I don't want to get into that too much. But
well,
I mean...
let me just tell you a quick story here. A friend of mine and I are working on a book that will be out next year. And he interviewed Dean Rusk. Who had been in the Kennedy administration and had been a good Democrat for a long time. Interviewed him a year before he died.
Mm-hmm.
And Dean Rusk essentially said, I want to give you like a deathbed confession. During World War II, Dean Rusk had been in charge of the intelligence on the Japanese fleet. And he was getting this information. The information was coming into him, into his office. And the fleet had split, as we all know now. In retrospect, the fleet had split, and we were able to track half the fleet, but we had lost the other half. I forget which was north and which was south, but we had lost half the Japanese fleet. And Dean Rusk had concluded that they were heading. It must have been the southern half because he had concluded that they were heading down to the Philippines. And so that's what he told Roosevelt. We've got them under control. We're pretty sure we know where they are. That was the half of the fleet that attacked Pearl Harbor. And when the teletype came into his office telling him that the Japanese fleet had attacked Pearl Harbor, his assistant brought it in. His assistant, who had worked with him very closely on all this stuff, his assistant brought that teletype in and said, oh, my God, look at this. This is terrible. And his assistant and he gathered together all of the papers that they had been sending to Roosevelt saying everything's fine, don't worry, put them in a metal wastebasket and burned them in his office. His assistant, by the way, was named John Kennedy.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, who brought Rusk into his administration. So, you know, for what it's worth, it's little stories. So I don't think that Roosevelt knew. I think that Roosevelt knew that
I think he did, too.
I don't think that he knew that the Japanese were going to attack us at Pearl Harbor. I think I do think that it was a strategic decision that he made when he cut off the Japanese at the Straits of Malacca. He cut off their oil supplies, that he knew that the Japanese would retaliate in some way. And just like Bush knew that Bin Laden was coming after us in some way.
That's what just told you. Well, yeah. I'm hoping I live long enough to see this group out of Washington.
There you go. From your lips to God's
ears. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Irene. Thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. And thank you for listening to us in Pittsburgh there on WPTT. I do appreciate it. Oh, my goodness. I want to get to this. What is Rick Santorum up to now? Right. This is just mind-boggling, just absolutely mind-boggling. The Senate yesterday voted to ban the Environmental Protection Agency from using studies that expose people to pesticides when considering permits for new pest killers. OK, it sounds like a good thing. In other words, we're going to say to the EPA, you know, you cannot do what Dr. Mengele did. There a lot of good information, a lot of good medical information came out of Dr. Mengele's experiments at Dachau. I've been to Dachau. I've seen the camp. I've seen some of the research that he did. It was horrific what he did. It was ungodly. I mean, he would put people in hyperbaric chambers and literally explode them. He was doing horrific things, and yet he was taking very careful notes, and a lot of good scientific data. That after the war, there was a big debate in the United States about, do we take the information that Mengele gathered, and for that matter, do we take the information that the Nazi secret intelligence service gathered about Russia and bring it into the United States? And ultimately, we decided to use it, and we brought a lot of Nazis into the Central Intelligence Agency. And this is, you know, I'm not talking out of school here. There's an entire book's been written about this. This is not some big secret. And into the rocket program, we have Wernher von Braun, you know, who's a good Nazi. Come on over, help us build rockets. The guy had been a Nazi, and he wasn't the only one. So anyhow, we brought these people in. But, you know, we really struggled with the ethics of it for a while there in the late 1940s. And there hasn't been much of a discussion about it since then. Until a couple of days ago on the floor of the Senate, when there have been these studies that have been done by industry where they go into low-income communities by and large, find pregnant women, and say, would you be willing to allow yourself to be exposed to these pesticides and these chemicals and these compounds, and we will pay you. And oddly, they were paying them with things like Sony Walkmen. We will pay you if you'll simply sign this release that says that we don't have any, there's no liability to us. And I talked about this on this program 6 months ago when it first came out that this was going on. So some decent scientific information has been gathered by some of these companies doing what many of us consider to be at the very least questionable and perhaps, in my opinion, unethical, should be illegal stuff. Now, in their defense, what they're saying is they were going into communities that were already exposed to pesticides. They were going to families of, you know, families who lived next to golf courses where there was all this drift of the pesticides and herbicides from the golf course, where they were going into communities where there were factories that were spewing toxins into the air. And they knew that these people were already being exposed to these things, or people who were using a lot of household cleaning products and things that were toxic. And they were simply saying, you know, you're already being exposed to this stuff. Just keep track of your health. Well, I think we should be going into those communities and saying, holy cow, you're being exposed to this stuff. We're going to clean it up. We're going to stop it. But no, that's not what they did. And the administration signed off on it. So anyhow, this goes before the Senate. And the question before the Senate was, all of this information has been gathered in these Dr. Mengele type experiments. I mean, they're not to the extreme of Dr. Mengele. But in these experiments or these questionnaires, these monitorings that are of questionable ethics, let's say. All this information has been gathered. Should the Environmental Protection Agency be able to use this information? And here's the problem. This is a real conundrum. On the one hand, if you say yes, you let them use the information, yeah, they've got more information. That's good for public health. On the other hand, if you let them use the information, that not only ratifies it, that's not only says to industry, hey, it's okay to keep doing this, but that actually encourages more of it. Oh, we're doing this with a stamp of approval from the EPA. They're using our information. So anyhow, the Senate voted to not allow the EPA to use it. But there were 37 senators who voted in favor of letting the EPA use this information. 37 senators who voted in favor of these pesticide studies on fetuses. Rick Santorum was right out in front of the whole pack. And almost all, it reads like a who's who of the so-called pro-life movement. I'm sorry, it is a who's who. And George Bush, by the way, is pushing the EPA to, quote, to accept data from human tests on children, pregnant women, newborns, infants, and fetuses, even on newborns of uncertain viability, could be tested, end quote. Bush and these 37 pro-life Republicans who claim that they care about the unborn support allowing corporations to test hazardous chemicals, as David Sirota notes, on fetuses and pregnant women. Henry Waxman. Congressman Henry Waxman, Senator Barbara Boxer, and Representative Hilda Solis wrote an op-ed about this. It was published yesterday. Titled, EPA Proposal Encourages Human Pesticide Experiments. And here's what they said. This is very straightforward. Reversing a moratorium established by the Clinton administration, the Environmental Protection Agency under the Bush administration is reviewing or plans to review over 20 studies that intentionally dosed human subjects with pesticides. The pesticides administered to human subjects in these experiments include, quote, highly hazardous, end quote, poisons, suspected carcinogens, and suspected neurotoxicants. The studies, which most of which were submitted to the EPA by pesticide manufacturers, appear to routinely violate ethical standards. The testing of pesticides on humans is controversial. Unlike pharmaceutical products, pesticides are designed to be toxic. And unlike pharmaceutical products, experiments that expose human subjects to doses of pesticides offer no promise of therapeutic benefit to the subjects. For these reasons, former EPA Administrator Carol Browner implemented a moratorium in 1998 on considering or relying upon human pesticide experiments. In other words, the Clinton administration said, sorry, we're not going to go there. However, writes these members of Congress, Waxman and Boxer, at the urging of pesticide manufacturers, the Bush administration reversed this moratorium. Reversed it. They did a study on this thing at the request of Senator Barbara Boxer and Representative Henry Waxman. A study was conducted. It evaluated 22 of the 24 human pesticide experiments submitted to the EPA. And here's what they found. In 22 of these studies, human testing of hazardous substances, the experiments deliberately exposed human subjects to dangerous pesticides such as organophosphates, which were developed in the 1930s for use in nerve gas, and methyl isocyanolate, which is closely related to the chemical that killed thousands in Bhopal, India. In one experiment, human subjects were placed in a chamber with vapors of chloropicrin, an active ingredient in tear gas, at levels substantially greater than the federal exposure limit, causing subjects to experience severe adverse effects. The informed consent forms used in the experiments do not appear to meet ethical standards. The consent form for the chloropicrin experiment states that the sponsors would not pay for any form of compensation if you are injured, other than direct medical costs. One experiment dosed, I'm reading from this report from Congress. One experiment dosed 8 subjects with the pesticide azoxystrobin for 28 days, with all 8 of the subjects reporting multiple adverse health effects, including headaches, abdominal pain, nausea, coughing, and rashes. In a written report of the experiment, the researchers discounted these events, attributing them variously to viral illnesses. In 14 of the studies, there was no medical follow-up after the first 24 hours. The Bush administration has justified the decision to accept human pesticide experiments by arguing that such studies are available, relevant, and appropriate. 37 pro-life senators voting to expose fetuses to pesticides. Yep, why do they love the unborn and hate the born? 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 4.5 minutes before the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Sorry, they shouldn't have access to the 14th Amendment. They shouldn't have access to the First Amendment. They shouldn't have access to the Fourth Amendment. They shouldn't have access to the Fifth Amendment. It's a corporation. It's not a person. Well, you know, tell that to a lawyer, right? U.S. Border Patrol conducted a survey, this from Cox News Service, of illegal immigrants at the Mexican border immediately after George Bush Jr. here, President Bush, announced his temporary worker plan last year. Yep, U.S. Border Patrol, your tax dollars at work. They said, let's find out here what's going on with, let's survey the illegal immigrants. 1,711 surveys. Asking the illegal immigrants, why did you come across the border? The survey was started on January 7th. It was supposed to last until June 7th. And guess what happened? After 25 days, they called it off. They stopped the survey. Why? Because they discovered that 45% of the illegal immigrants who were crossing the border from Mexico into the United States did so, said they were doing so because they had heard that George W. Bush wanted to give them amnesty. And they wanted to be in the United States when that amnesty happened. I mean, not only does his insane trade policies destroy our jobs, ship them overseas, wipe out small businesses, his insane refusal to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act, allow big corporations to get bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where it's impossible, or it's very difficult now, for the small entrepreneurs and the small family businesses in this country to even start, much less survive and succeed over time. But now his immigration policies are further destroying job opportunities in the United States and encouraging illegal immigration. And then they tried to cover it up. The Bush administration tried to cover this thing up. And it's just now leaking out. Probably the only person in all of the media who will even discuss it will be Lou Dobbs. You just watch. Amazing. Well, thanks for being with us today, folks. My friends, I really appreciate it. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy. Yes, democracy to this great republic, the United States of America.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.